Welcome to Healthy Outcomes, brought to you by Baker Tilly, bringing you the latest trends and hottest topics in healthcare. Baker Tilly is a leading advisory, tax, and assurance firm dedicated to helping healthcare organizations explore ways in which they can win now and anticipate tomorrow. Let's go there.
Hi, my name is Mark Ross, and I'm the leader of Baker Tilly's healthcare provider practice. Joining me for today's Healthy Outcomes podcast is Krista Pankop. Krista leads Baker Tilly's not-for-profit practice and also leads Baker Tilly's behavioral health practice. Welcome, Krista, and thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, today, Krista and I will discuss several topics related to one of her specialties, which I just mentioned earlier, behavioral health. Krista recently attended the annual National Council for Mental Well-Being Conference, or NatCon, where a whole host of behavioral health topics were discussed. So all of the topics that Krista and I are going to be discussing here are front of mind for her because, again, she's fresh off this conference where all these things were discussed. So Krista, let's dive right into it. And let's start with demand. The demand for behavioral health services in this country certainly has been elevated significantly over the last several years. You know, COVID drove some of that elevated demand for sure. But as you work with our clients, Krista, you know, you attended the conference, you heard a lot relative to, I'm sure, the demand for behavioral health services, the current demand and what the future outlook is. You know, what are you hearing on the demand side of things?
You know, Mark, the first words that were spoken at the conference is that the behavioral health sector has the nation's attention. And I think part of the reason we have the nation's attention is that there's so much demand. So there's some recent studies that 40% of U.S. adults report struggles with mental health or substance abuse. So that's almost half of our population needs assistance. And it takes almost 10 years for when someone reports mental health symptoms till they can actually get treatment or they want to get treatment. And 50% of mental health illness happens before the age of 14. So if you think about that, when someone starts to struggle and it's really 24 before they start to seek treatment, so much of their lives have passed. So as a sector, we're talking about how do we see individuals quicker? How can we get a workforce that actually can assist the people who need help? 40% of adults, there's not enough workforce to help that now. And then how can we make that treatment quicker for when someone starts to go through the continuum, they can get the help that they need?
Well, that is astounding, Kristen. Some of our listeners that are in tune with what's happening in the behavioral health sector, you know, might be aware of that statistic, but I mean, 40% of U.S. adults having this need, you know, struggling with mental health or substance abuse is a really high percentage.
And I think too, you know, has it always been that way? And we're just talking about it more. I think now with social media and people can see, you know, people that look like them are actually talking about mental health challenges and other challenges that they're having. So it's top of mind for some people. And when you can see people who look like you, you're more apt to talk about it. So, you know, I'm not sure if that's always been there or if it's just an increased demand or just we can talk about it more without the stigma.
Sure. Which is actually a very positive thing, right? Talking about it without the stigma and getting people the help that they need. And so, Krista, you know, the demand is there, right? The demand is there and behavioral healthcare providers across the country are doing their best to respond to that demand. On the flip side of that, as they're responding, they need to get paid for the services they're providing. They need to get paid fairly to sustain their business models and to continue providing the care that's so needed in their communities. So the concept of parity, Krista, I'm sure was talked about at the conference as well. Parity being, again, reimbursement, fair pay, if you will, right, for these behavioral health providers and the services they provide. Can you talk a bit about the concept of parity and, you know, what was talked about at the conference relative to providing these providers, getting these providers the reimbursement they need to, again, sustain their business models?
Sure. And you couldn't see it because obviously we're just talking, but I smiled when you mentioned parity because we've been talking about parity for quite some time. And the concept is a provider who assists a patient with mental health should be reimbursed on the same level as someone who helps them when they break their leg. And part of the problem with that is that you can see when a leg is broken, you can't always see the mental health challenges. So there have been laws in place to try to create parity. I would say that they've been somewhat successful, but not very. You know, when we look at treatment, we should be talking about a whole person and not just like one doctor sees them from the head up and one doctor sees them from the head down. And really what parity is supposed to do is help in that push so that we can really look as a person as an entire individual. Some of the discussions that were happening are when we talk about parity, should we be talking about integration at the same time? Because, you know, you look at primary doctors and they're just overwhelmed, right? So try to put one more thing on their plate to say, hey, let's have you also start looking at mental health resources with your patients and move them over. And then we can add that, you know, part of a bundle. It's overwhelming. So can we get them mental health or substance abuse resources to step in when they see those things? So more integration and really bi-directional integration. So if someone is at a CCBHC and they're getting treatment, we should be looking at primary care as well. And so if we can get the doctors and the social workers to start to think about we're all one continuum, hopefully the payers will look at us the same way. But it's very recent that Medicaid gave us codes for integrated health. So we recently just got 33 different Medicaid codes that did not exist previously. CCBHCs are a brand new framework in the last few years. And there are certain departments within the federal government who don't believe in parity and still do not pay what it takes for the cost for someone to actually get help for mental health or substance abuse. And as long as that gap is there, the treatment is not going to expand because providers, we have a workforce shortage, are going to go into primary care. So, or they're going to go to a hospital and work on behavioral health instead of being out in the community. So parity is really holding back treatment and also holding back the workforce for that treatment.
Interesting, Krista. And it seems to me, as you were talking there, such a simple issue to fix, but yet it is probably highly complicated from a Medicaid perspective, commercial payer perspective, et cetera, to achieve this parity. But I have to imagine that the clinicians, and as you know, I'm not a clinician. You and I are both CPAs, right? But the clinicians have to support this concept of parity. And I'm sure primary care physicians want that for their behavioral health counterparts because they are in this game together.
It's hard to argue that there aren't certain things that are caused by someone's mental health where they also have basically primary health challenges or vice versa. And it seems unusual to think that they're that separate and that they're not interdependent. So I think as a primary care doc, it would be very frustrating to try to treat part of something when you know there's more there. So I think parity would help with that integration and make everyone's jobs easier.
That's a great point, Krista. I think you and I can spend another 20 to 30, the rest of the podcast talking about the topic of parity, but let's move on. Very well said though on that topic. I think we hit the points that needed to be hit there. So let's talk a bit about private equity. And this is really pivoting to a completely different topic relative to behavioral health. But we know private equity firms out there across the country, Krista, are investing in healthcare providers across the whole healthcare continuum, right? It's not just behavioral health, or it's not just dermatology practices or other surgery centers, things of that nature. They're investing in healthcare across the board. And behavioral health is not immune to that. Significant dollars being invested by private equity into behavioral health. What did you hear at the conference? What are you seeing out there relative to private equity investment in the sector? And do you believe it's going to continue for the foreseeable future?
Well, let me start with yes, it's going to continue because of the demand. You know, private equity dollars go where the demand is and where they can make a profit. And as behavioral health expands, I think we're a great area for them to come into. The first thing I heard at the conference was the discussion of how the private equity firms, as they're coming into our sector, are really leading with engagement. I think there's an interesting dynamic. Many of the behavioral health providers are not for profit. And there's a certain level of care and a certain nuance when you're a not-for-profit provider. And maybe there's some suspicion of a private equity business model. And then maybe as the private equity is coming in, they're thinking of the not-for-profit provider as they could be, you know, much more business-focused. So it's an interesting dynamic. So there was a lot of discussion as private equity is trying to understand what we do and how they can make it better. You know, there were some numbers thrown out, $20 billion been invested by private equity in behavioral health so far. I don't see those numbers going down, especially when you look at a lot of our providers were started by one very strong individual, you know, maybe that individual is coming to the point of retirement. Maybe there's, because of the workforce shortage, you don't have the next leader in-house. You know, you have choices. Do you find another not-for-profit to combine with? Could you bring in private equity and be part of a larger organization? I think those discussions are happening in real time.
Got it. And you did touch on there, Krista, which is interesting. I actually meant to weave it into my question initially, but you weaved it into your response without being asked. But it's private equity firms are not just out there looking for-profit behavioral health providers, right? They're talking to not-for-profits as well. But yeah, I can understand. I mean, you're our not-for-profit sector leader. You work with not-for-profit organizations for the vast majority of your career. I can, to a certain extent, understand the reluctance there on the not-for-profit organization side to engage maybe in that dialogue. But it is going to keep happening, and it's not bad dialogue, right? I mean, worst case scenario is if not-for-profit providers engage in those discussions, you know, they're likely to learn something, you know, what the private equity firm strategy is, you know, why they're getting into it, what their outlook is, et cetera. Does that make sense to you?
It does. And you know, we just got done talking about parity, and behavioral health is an unusual model because we do not get paid by payers or the government our costs. So usually a not-for-profit is trying to cobble together funding. So there's some contributions that we're putting together with a government grant, and then we're also getting Medicaid to come up with resources to serve the public, right? It's very much some of these, you know, they're trying really hard to do what they need to do. PE is interesting because it brings in resources that could help with technology and needs and bricks and mortar and other things that not-for-profits would love to do if they only had, you know, a big pot of money. So there's obviously lots of decisions as you have to go through that. But I think PE is going to bring in resources to let some organizations move forward at a pace that they haven't expected previously.
Sure. No, well said, Krista. And again, let me be clear with our audience here. Krista and I are not suggesting that private equity is the answer, right? For every not-for-profit provider out there, we're just suggesting that, you know, private equity is going to continue. Private equity firms are going to continue to play a role in this space in the foreseeable future. And organizations just need to be aware of it. I mean, that it's happening around you, and just be aware of, always good to be aware of what's happening in the environment in which you operate.
It's one tool in the toolkit when you're looking at how to move forward.
Yep, for sure. Good deal. So pivoting again, Krista, to another topic here, government engagement is what I'll call this topic. And I already mentioned the concept of funding. You mentioned earlier the CCBHC model, which are certified community behavioral health clinics that are popping up all over the country. You know, so maybe from an overall government engagement, government regulation perspective, Krista, what did you hear at the conference? Maybe talk a little bit more about the evolution of the CCBHC model, et cetera. Share with us the highlights there.
Maybe I should start by talking a little bit about the CCBHC, since I did drop the initials and didn't go into what those organizations are in case someone's not aware. So it is a clinic. It's a specially designed clinic, and it provides a comprehensive range of mental health and substance abuse services. They serve anyone who walks in the door, regardless of diagnosis or insurance status. So it was created by law. It's a federal definition and a criteria. It's in Medicaid as a type of provider. And that just became permanent, which is super exciting for our sector. And it's basically comprehensive care from soup to nuts. Because of that, CCBHCs received an enhanced Medicaid reimbursement rate based on anticipated costs, because it's going to be complex populations that they're dealing with, because they have to take anyone who comes. They're usually not-for-profits or local units of government, and they must directly provide or bring in other providers as part of their network, 9 types of services with an emphasis on 24-hour crisis care, evidence-based practices, care coordination with local primary care and hospital partners, and integration with physical health care. So a lot of what we were talking about previously, when you talk about parity and the needs, have been wrapped into the CCBHC model. There are 500 of them right now throughout the United States, and they touch 60% of the nation's population. So they've been hugely successful. Providers are touching way more people. We're seeing great outcomes in them. So we're excited that they're permanent. But there's only $65 million in the fiscal year 25 budget additional for new CCBHCs. So as we talk about funding and what we'd love to have for funding, this is one of the areas that I think we could see enhanced funding within the CCBHC model, just to have more of these models throughout the United States.
Well, Crystal, before you get into maybe some of the other regulatory updates or things you heard at the conference, if I'm a behavioral health provider today, and I'm going to put you on the spot here to ask you this question. If I'm a behavioral health provider today, I'm not a CCBHC, but I want to become one. How cumbersome is that process? I guess I need to look at my business model and see how it aligns with the CCBHC requirements and then build those different services, those elements of, I guess, the care continuum into what I offer, what I provide to the community in which I operate. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So you really need to determine if you are in a demonstration state. So a state that has been basically deemed by the federal government to be a state to create CCBHC model within their state, or a state who is creating their own CCBHC model. And there's two different types. So there are states, Illinois is one of them, where they've created funding throughout their state for basically CCBHC lookalikes in anticipation of becoming a federal demonstration state. And then there's other states who have been demonstration states like Minnesota, where the model's already set up. So that's the first thing, because you want to make sure you're going to get paid to set up that model.
Sure.
Then the next thing you should do is, can you serve the population like I just described? Can you have 24-hour care? Do you have crisis intervention? Do you have partners who can assist with primary care? So the thought process behind this is, you can't put someone on a wait list for 6 months. Like, you're seeing them within hours, not days. So can you do that? Or are there things you need to do internally to be able to serve the public like that? The other thing that goes along with this level of funding is, there are ratios and metrics that need to be consistently reported to show that you're meeting what is required of you as a CCBHC. So if your back room can't do that, if you are very paper heavy, if you cannot know wait times, other metrics that you would need to report back to Medicaid, that's some work you should do before you actually look at this model. But if you have all those things in place, usually 30% higher reimbursement with a CCBHC than without a CCBHC, and less workforce challenges, because you can translate that extra funding into paying your people, and better outcomes, because we're helping a person and the whole person again, not just their head. So I think overall, it's a really interesting and innovative model. It's akin to an FQHC, if that helps people understand that terminology a little bit better, but really aimed at a behavioral health model.
No, great advice, Chris. I mean, it sounds like with the elevated reimbursement, more comprehensive care to the community you're operating in, it does seem to make sense. But as you said, there are a whole host of, let's call it, infrastructure type things that an organization would need to have in place or develop, right? Develop to actually be able to roll out this model. But it seems like it would be worth, again, if you're in one of those demonstration states, got to check that first. It seems like it would certainly be worth investigating if you're a provider out there in those states.
Without question. And there are preparation grants available. So also something to look at. So if you're interested, you can check with your state. You can, you know, look at, if you are within a demonstration state, they actually go through and will give you grants to be ready. So when day one hits, you're up and running and you're not already behind the eight ball.
Great. So what else do you have on the regulatory front for us, Krista?
So substance abuse continues to be talked about in the State of the Union. So when we talk about stigma and bringing it out in the forefront, I think that's something to have top of mind, that the government is looking at that. The national prescription opiate litigation continues. If you're not aware of that, it's very similar to what happened with tobacco, where multiple states and multiple counties and multiple municipalities sued the pharmaceutical and drug distribution companies for the opioid epidemic. And so what is happening is, that's been centralized. And based on that centralization of the litigation, there's a new system being put in place to get the funding that's coming out of that back to the states. So right now there's $54 billion available to states and localities through various agreements. And it's not just an agreement for 24 months. Some of these agreements are 18 years. And at least 70% of these opioid funds need to be used in opioid remediation efforts. So maybe some of the ills that happened with the tobacco settlement, where it didn't go back to remediating tobacco use, it went to roads and other things the state needed. This really needs to be working on the opioid epidemic. But if providers are interested in these funds, Google it. It varies by state, and it's not coming through all the normal channels. It might be coming through your attorney general's office versus your Department of Health. I sit in Wisconsin. It is coming through our Department of Health. But you can look and see how your state's using the funds, and if you can help with the use of what should be happening within your state, and then should you be applying to receive some of this funding coming through.
Okay, and maybe one final thought that was on my mind, Krista, from a regulatory perspective, would be the privacy rules. So the federal privacy rules, you know, healthcare providers are all aware of HIPAA. Can you talk a little bit about, and I'm not 100% sure myself, what the differences are between a behavioral healthcare provider and other types of healthcare providers on the privacy side of things? But I do believe there are differences, some nuances there.
There are. And as you said before, that, you know, we're not doctors, we're also not attorneys. So I'm going to do my best to do this in an accounting speak, and obviously check with your legal counsel on anything I talk about here. But the federal privacy rules for treatment records are different than other records. So it's 42 CFR Part 2, so it's often referred to as Part 2. And what Part 2 is trying to do is protect the, I'm quoting now, protect the records of the identity, diagnosis, prognosis, or treatment of any patient, which is maintained in connection with the performance of any program or activity relating to substance abuse disorder, prevention, education, training, treatment, rehabilitation, or research. So that's a big swath of what providers do in behavioral health that's under this Part 2. So it's akin to HIPAA, but it's, let's say, a level up from HIPAA. And it's now changed 5 times in the last 7 years. And the whole thought about Part 2 is that if people have strong confidence and confidentiality, that will bring them into treatment. So if they know that their information will be linked to their, you know, employer or their insurance company without their knowledge, they're more apt to come for help. So I mentioned it's more restrictive than HIPAA. The newest version is in effect now, but it doesn't go into compliance for 2 years. The difference between the rules previously and now are a little nuanced. You may want to look at that, but maybe what people need to know today is the enforcement and penalties are now actually going to happen. So previously, there were rules, there wasn't a lot of enforcement. They've actually created a group that will look at enforcement and penalties that will align with HIPAA. And now there is a new that you have to notify if there's a breach that hasn't been in the law previously. So if you're a provider that maybe hasn't always known your HIPAA regulations, maybe you've had breaches, maybe there's something that's been that you're like, we should really look at this. If you're a behavioral health provider, you want to look at this Part 2 and make sure that you're ready for the step up. You know, some of the things they were talking about is that you can't send to insurance companies any of this information without the approval of the patient. So if you want to get reimbursed, you need the patient consent before you can send it if it's under Part 2. So there's some system things that need to be done there, because especially if you are a hospital, you're doing more than what would be covered under Part 2. How can you make sure the Part 2, you know, behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse is covered, and then your other items are still under HIPAA? So I think there's some challenges with that that providers are going to need to look at.
Sure. No, a lot there, Krista. You know, you mentioned earlier with the CCBHC model, making sure you've got the back office to produce the ratios, the metrics that you need to produce or monitor, provide to the Medicaid program. You know, you need to make sure you've got the back office here too, from a technology perspective, just a,
yes.
You know, that someone has to be responsible. Somebody has to own compliance with, well, it's really compliance with all applicable laws and regulations. The privacy rules just happen to be one of many laws and regulations that providers need to comply with. But the enforcement and penalties, which you touched on, they are happening, right? They are happening out there. So it's critically important for organizations to make sure they, you know, they're dotting the I's and crossing the T's relative to privacy.
And I don't want to make assumptions for everybody who's listening, but I know I have clients that pre-COVID were heavily paper-driven. They were not using, you know, any technology, and they had to move to technology through COVID. So I would say that their systems of controls around their IT system continue to evolve. I think this is something that many providers are going to need to look at as their systems maybe aren't yet to where they want them to be based on resource constraints. And now there can be fines and penalties above and beyond that that they're going to need to worry about.
Yeah. So we talk about resource constraints, funding constraints. I think you're making reference to there, Krista, when you say that. So it is difficult for these providers to make certain of these investments when they don't, you know, potentially don't have a lot of excess cash flow to invest in these types of things. But you touched on earlier too, one of the things you talked about was fund development efforts, raising money, you know, through that avenue if you're a not-for-profit organization, maybe to support some of these initiatives as well. So Krista, the last thing I want to touch on with you during our discussion here, and our time has just flown by as it always does on all of these podcasts that I do, but you mentioned the word workforce, or maybe it's two words, workforce. I have it as one here. I have it as it depends on how you spell it. Yeah. So you mentioned that several times, and certainly workforce, healthcare is not the only industry in this country struggling with workforce challenges these days. It's really an industry agnostic issue, but it is hitting healthcare very, very hard. And behavioral health providers are not immune to these challenges. So what are you hearing, seeing when you're talking to our clients? What did you hear at NatCon relative to workforce challenges? And you know, what's being done out there to mitigate some of these challenges?
Well, I would say talking to our clients and being at the conference, I think frustration is a good word to use, because I would say the workforce challenge is still there. Even though you may not hear it over and over again because there's fatigue, there definitely is workforce challenges. I mentioned parity before. We talked about integration. That's really a barrier for workforce challenges. And there was a provider there that was talking about how they will get a young professional, they will be there for 2 years, and because of their funding constraints, they can't give them the raises that they could get normally at a for-profit. And so they're losing them to the hospital down the street within 2 years. So when parity can be solved, that can help the workforce challenge. But right now it's how do you keep good people when they can get paid more going 2 or 3 blocks away from your organization? CMS was there and they, you know, addressed the workforce challenge, which I thought was brave of them. They discussed, can we use telehealth? They're looking at better reimbursement for pay. They talked about parity, how they can put more teeth in their enforcement around parity, holding the payers accountable. They also mentioned Section 1115 demonstrations, where they can actually go through and maybe, let's call it, suspend the rules if you have something innovative that you think could work. You know, maybe normally somebody would have to be licensed to do a certain thing, but can we come up with something innovative where CMS or the state would actually approve? You know, a lot of things they talked about were peer support, peer counselors. They're very, very effective when working with substance abuse, but in many cases, they're not allowed to do the work or be reimbursed for the work. So that was one of the things that was discussed. We mentioned the CCBHC model previously, you know, higher salaries by 30%. That obviously is helpful. There was a state that was there, and their State Department talked about how they're working on loan forgiveness. So if you work in behavioral health and many of those positions need master's degrees and they're not paid, let's say, is that what you would think you would with a master's degree? If you stay for a certain amount of time, the state will pay your student loans. So I thought that was pretty innovative. I had not heard that previously. You know, there was talk about, can we have housing for our workforce? Is there a way that right now there are certain laws where if you have been had a crime, you cannot help in behavioral health in certain areas? But again, going back to that peer support network, maybe for substance abuse, that doesn't make sense because many of the peer supports have gone through challenges and they've come out the other side. So I would say it's still a problem. No one's cracked the nut. People are thinking about it, but I don't think it's going to go away. And we started by talking that demand is higher than it's ever been. So it's definitely a pull at both sides.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Krista, like you said, we don't have any, you know, magic pill here to correct the workforce challenges. I think that providers are going to continue to be on this road, trying to be innovative and think of different ways for their organization that they can recruit and retain caregivers more effectively. And you mentioned, you know, some resources, some of the workforce maybe going 2 or 3 blocks from your organization to work somewhere else. That's not working somewhere else at another healthcare provider. That could be, again, in a completely different industry where they're getting paid a higher wage as well. Again, if you're not a you mentioned the master's folks that are in the behavioral health sector, but there's other caregivers as well, right? That, might, work at an Amazon warehouse, for example, if the wages are,
yes,
are a bit higher. So no doubt funding comes into play there. Funding comes into play relative to what we're, these providers are able to pay to their workforce. Well, Krista, we covered a lot in the last 30 or so minutes. Did we miss anything that you wanted to share with our audience? I mean, we covered a broad range of topics here, but maybe you want to go broader.
I really feel like I hit the highlights, but I think, as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about this, and I could probably talk for another hour or two. Maybe we'll have to have a part two.
Sure. And listen, you're always welcome on our podcast here, Krista. So, well, listen, thank you so much for joining me today. And I want to thank our listeners for joining this podcast. If you found this episode useful and would like to listen to more episodes about hot topics in the healthcare industry, please subscribe to our Healthy Outcomes podcast or learn more by visiting us at bakertilly.com. Krista, thank you again.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening. To receive notifications when new episodes are available, please subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts. For additional resources, check out bakertilly.com.